Sealands Grove to Somerset, Phillipsburg to White Oak, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, so-called democratic socialism is all the rage on the left, but it has never worked anywhere it has been tried. David Taylor of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is here with Rebecca Euler from the National Federation of Independent Business and the Commonwealth Foundation's Stephen Bloom for a Capital Watch roundtable discussion. And the Pennsylvania General Assembly is considering changes to how we elect appellate court judges and the state's lieutenant governor. I'll have a town hall commentary on why the proposals have merit. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. A look at the economic devastation and civil war in Venezuela should be enough to dissuade anyone from wanting the United States to become a socialist nation. Yet that is precisely what is being proposed by most of the Democratic presidential candidates and by many Democrats in Congress. Here to talk about why socialism has failed everywhere and every time it has been tried is our Capital Watch crew, David Taylor, Rebecca Euler, and Stephen Bloom. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, Rebecca Euler, Legislative Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. Rebecca, thanks so much for being on the show.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And also our pal, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on, David.
So there's a fever that is run amok in society today. It's bad thinking. It's wrongheadedness, and it can only be described with one word, and that is socialism. So my favorite description of socialism comes from Winston Churchill, who compared it to a man standing in a bucket trying to lift himself up by the handle. And I think that that's pretty vivid and pretty accurate. And again, what a paradox that here we are at this moment in the 21st century where we are at the absolute apogee of quality of life, that all of the global indicators for extreme poverty are going down. All of the indicators for infant mortality are going down. All of the indicators for life expectancy are going up. And for those of us who've been around, even, you know, just as old as we are, we remember the way the world used to be when we were kids. The technological wonders that we have, not just in the consumer goods space, but also in terms of the quality of healthcare. I mean, like things that people would just like flat out die from. We have treatments and therapies and cures for. It's astonishing. All of this has been driven by what? By the innovation and risk-taking of individuals and businesses to lead us to the place where we are. And yet somehow there's this fashionable trend that somehow we're supposed to all chuck it away and go the way of state control. How is this happening?
It does seem like almost a pop culture phenomenon that people have just suddenly decided that socialism is cool, or at least it sounds cool, and therefore, you know, let's be socialists. And they aren't aware, apparently, of the really dreadful history of mankind and the absolute horrible tragedies that have taken place. Not only in the distant past, but even this year, last month in Venezuela, whenever socialism is imposed. Time and time again, without exception, the imposition of socialism leads to an overall decrease in the well-being of people, whether it's their actual – what's in their bank account, their wealth, their health, their futures, and yet
– and their freedom.
Their freedoms. It typically ends up being wrapped in totalitarianism because of its very nature. It almost needs that to be able to survive once people catch on that this is not actually helping them. And so it's been a dreadful, tragic, terrible history, but yet suddenly it's funny and cute and fun to talk about socialism and literally vote for candidates who proclaim themselves to be socialists like it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I find it interesting, too, that everybody I've had this discussion with says, well, in Venezuela, for example, they just haven't done it right. you know, they didn't do socialism right. We have to do it right. But the lack of historical understanding, it's never right. It absolutely is never right throughout history. Socialism inherently causes government to have more power. It has to, because it allocates resources to interests, across the society through the government. So that requires the government to have lots of power. And when you have a government that has lots of power, individual abilities and individual rights suffer, because they're always pitting winners against losers. They're always picking winners and losers, which, you know, to take that a step farther, makes people enemies of mm-hmm. each other, because mm-hmm. when the government picks winners and losers, it causes tribalism. It causes us to view, you know, people to view ourselves as opposed to someone else because they've been picked as a winner. And it just causes misery throughout, you know, the whole society. And it's just never right.
Yeah. And it's unlimited promises. I tried to, to explain this to my daughter, who's in elementary school. I said, here's the deal. I will promise to give you everything you've ever wanted. All you have to do is give up your freedom forever. Hmm. Like, that's the promise that socialism makes. They're promising all this stuff, but you have to give up control over your life. I remember I was a lecturer at a college, and that it was I was there with a very leftist economics professor, and that he was pitching statism, pitching socialism, and to this group of international students. And I said to them, I said, stop and think about the amount of control that the government would have over you and over your lives in order to be able to deliver all of the things that the professor is promising to you. And I said, you think about the mass amount of power in one person's hands to control you, to control your lives. I said, there's only one person who can be entrusted with that much power, and that person is me. So yes, I will volunteer to take over as the chairman of the Central Committee of the Communist Party, and I will run your economy. I will run your lives. And then, of course, I'm joking, but that's the thing. Like, this is why we, each one of us, need to be the captain of our own fates.
I'd like to come back to something that Rebecca said. She talked about how defenders of socialism often claim that, well, it just wasn't done right. If it had been done right, it would have worked. Think about that in comparison to capitalism. We're not sitting here saying that capitalism is perfect. We're saying that capitalism, wherever it's tried and how badly it's done, the biggest side effect is that people who were previously poor become prosperous. Even elements of capitalism start to lift people permanently from poverty to prosperity.
Yes. And even in the Soviet Union, when they when their agriculture sector completely failed as a last-ditch effort to stave off starvation, they allowed people to have their own private gardens. In very short order, those small private plots where people could, you know, reap the benefits of what they had raised, those small plots were feeding more of the population than the large collectivized farms.
And you look at China, which several decades ago was still mired deeply in pure communism, or their best effort to run a communistic society. But then they kind of looked around the world and realized, oh, those who are adopting free market principles actually end up doing much better economically. We want a piece of that. And so even though they're by no means a perfect system of capitalism today, they've adopted free market policies that allow for at least that segment of their society to operate in a capitalistic competitive system. And you've seen China just transform itself from a sort of a global backwater to a global powerhouse because of adopting the principles of the free market and abandoning many of the principles of socialism.
Yeah.
The more market you have in a place, the better the human development. The countries do much better under market economics. Everybody does much better under market economics. Actually, just read a statistic recently that in order to be in the top 10% of the world's income, you need to make $12,000 a year. So the poverty line in America is above that. I think we could say that the United States has well outpaced, you know, through its market economic system, has made everyone prosperous from the perspective of world economics. So, and that happens everywhere where market economics is tried.
Well, amen, and may it be ever so. You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me, Rebecca Euler from NFIB Pennsylvania and Steve Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation. So I want to get back to the allure of the, I guess it's just the, is it just the fantasy? Is it just the, is it just that, that siren song of things should be better than they are, and that it should be easy, that, that somebody should just like flip a switch or press a button and, you know, and fulfill my every desire, that state collectivism has yielded nothing but misery in every iteration, and that individual rights, property rights, freedom of contract, freedom of action, that this has led to great bounty wherever it's been allowed. What is the thought process, or what is the emotional process that leads people to say, yes, I want a bunch of free stuff now?
Well, I think because we've been so successful as a society, and because we've had our, most of our needs met as a people, that we're able to be to look inward and be more compassionate. So I think that actually makes the emotional appeal of socialism a little bit stronger. And we were talking about it, maybe the cool thing now. I think we in some ways that a lot of people find socialism to be attractive because they think, you know, we're well enough off that everybody should, or everybody deserves to be better. And I think that's the emotional appeal of it. But like I said, it just, when it comes to facts, it just doesn't pan out, because if we were to go back and sort of rescind some of those market economic principles that our society is built on, we will slide backwards.
And it's also, I mean, we have today an awful lot of redistributionism. I mean, a major percentage of our national economy is devoted to income transfer programs to care for people who are less well off, and that is for the benefit of those disadvantaged people, but it's also for the benefit of society as a whole, that we want to have a stable society, an orderly society, and it's destabilizing to have large numbers of people who are miserable and suffering. But I think the people who are of a bent to say we want this, maybe we want even a whole lot more of it, fail to understand you cannot redistribute wealth that hasn't been created yet.
Right, exactly. Yep.
I think it was Margaret Thatcher who said that socialism is a creed of ignorance and a gospel of envy.
I think that was actually Churchill. Said that. Mrs. Thatcher is the one who said that the problem with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money.
The envy piece is really key, because to promote socialism and to attract people to socialism, you'll notice that the politicians who are out there doing that always are appealing to one's sense of envy. They're trying to say that that other guy across town or across the country or across the street has more than you, and we can do something about that.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to help you make sure you have as much as him. And that's that they're playing on humanity's natural sense of being vulnerable to envy. You know, we all see somebody who has stuff that's better than us, or seems to have a life that's better than us.
Right.
And we might feel like, gosh, I would like that. There could be constructive envy where you say, you know what, I'm going to work as hard as he or she did so I can have that.
Mm-hmm.
Or if someone comes to your house and says, you know what, I'm running for office, and if I win, I can help you get as much as he has without you doing anything different.
I will use the power of the state to coerce
and that's that
out of the other person.
The gospel of envy. And that's the underlying energy behind socialism and why people are susceptible to falling for the pitch.
And this is why, again, Western civilization and the Judeo-Christian creed, thou shalt not covet, there's a reason for that.
Yeah, and the frustrating thing is that when you give your government officials the ability to choose who benefits and pick winners and losers, you inspire corruption, and you inspire the government to you know, choose yes. in its own interest.
Yes, as the saying goes, when you rob Peter to pay Paul, you always have Paul's vote.
Right, exactly. But not only that, but it also contributes, I think, to like you said, the gospel of envy. Us against them is not a healthy way to run a society. You cannot have winners and losers chosen by official government and have a productive society that can get along with each other.
Think about the cooperation that capitalism stimulates.
Right. Yeah,
it doesn't require an order from on high. People just do things that help other people because there's a slight profit motive in it for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mutual benefit.
You think about Milton Friedman's famous explanation of who knows how to make a pencil? Nobody actually knows how to make a pencil because there's so many people involved in making a simple wooden pencil. You have people who mine the graphite. You have people who first planted a tree and then later cut down a tree and made it into lumber in tiny little slivers and slices in the right size. There's people who made paint. There's people who made the little rubber eraser. There's people who made the metal that goes on the little thing that attaches the eraser to the pencil, all of whom often don't know each other, don't care about each other, but were willing to cooperate in making a pencil just because there was a small incentive for them through the price system to do something, to go out and plant a tree or whatever it may be. But they cooperated spontaneously for the good of mankind. Think of how a socialist would make a pencil.
Mm-hmm. Well,
what would happen? How would they do it?
And
would they have to do?
And that's where, and of course, once society steps on that particular landmine, then that's the road to what we see today in Venezuela, where you lose those functions. It reminds me of the old Soviet joke: they pretend to pay us, and we pretend to work. Mm-hmm. When you're cut off from that whole risk reward dynamic of a free economy, that everything becomes sclerotic. Everything becomes mired.
Well, and to take it a step further than that, I talked about happiness. If you have a profit motive and you have people mutually cooperating for their own benefit, it leads to greater happiness because people find rewards in their work. So you'll find that where free market economies are, people generally tend to be happier because they can be successful if they work hard. And there's a lot of affirmation and happiness that comes from working hard and being successful.
Yes. And it's funny, Rebecca, because that was one of the very things that I said to that group of international students that I was lecturing to say that in a free society and in a free market, that you will be able to manifest your talents. You will be able to pursue your passions. You will be able to get good at the thing that you want to be doing. You will find your own way forward. Whereas in a command and control economy, you will essentially be a cog in the machine that will use you the way it wants you to be used, rather than you being the one who makes those decisions.
And you won't have access to the things that you want and need for your own. For yourself and for your own family.
Right.
And you go back to those pencils. Like in a capitalistic society, pencils are cheap. They're abundant. If you need a pencil, you can go to the neighborhood store or go online and order a pencil, and they're readily available as you need them, when you need them, the way you want them.
Mm-hmm.
In a command and control socialist economy, first some bureaucrat has to decide we need pencils. We need a certain kind of pencils, and we need X amount of pencils, and we need them at a certain time. They have no way to know if their guess is going to be right.
And it isn't.
There's not a market system of price signals from thousands of data points all over the country, or millions of data points all over the country, indicating how many pencils are needed, when they're needed, where they're needed, and what kind.
Because there's no penalty for being wrong. If you are a private business person and you miscalculate, you lose money. And that's why the next go round, if you're still able to be in business, that you learn that lesson, you're better calibrated, you're better attuned, that government is completely numb, completely insensitive.
That's why you end up with, in socialist countries like Venezuela, like we just saw, that the store shelves are empty. People are having to kill wild animals to eat their meals because the market signals weren't followed. Some government bureaucrat's idea of how much meat we need took control, and it utterly fails because they can't predict what's needed.
I wonder if we could just talk for a minute about how I don't know that anyone recognizes. I mean, we can talk in broad strokes about what socialism is and how it fails, but can people recognize it in the policy debate today? What are the specific things that are being raised that are socialist? And I'd like to just bring an example of like Medicare for all. Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite examples. So use that as an example of what socialism would look like. And it's a great example because generally, you would have all the doctors, nurses, all the hospitals taking their payment from the federal government and taking their orders from the government. When you have a system like that, there's no innovation, there's no motivation for finding new medical treatments, for finding new ways of doing things, for saving lives, for finding new ways to save lives, because there's no motive to do it. You just need to follow the government's orders. So that's one practical application of what we're talking about here. There are others. The $15 minimum wage, I'd argue, is another socialistic, policy that we're discussing. If you require $15 minimum wages, businesses are not going to be able to afford to hire people. They're going to have less time and less resources to innovate. So that's going to crush the innovative spirit, the entrepreneurial spirit of citizens. So are there other examples of what we're seeing in socialism policy debates here today?
Well, I just want to emphasize one of the points that you made. I mean, our medical professionals undergo many years of training, and that the government programs, the government health programs, have lower reimbursement rates. So, I mean, ultimately, right. You cannot compel people to practice medicine. And if through, government intervention that we make it less prosperous livelihood, people who have the innate ability to be able to reach that level of achievement, they'll just do something else with their lives, and they won't practice medicine.
And then
we are all poorer,
yes,
because we don't have enough right. people to care for us.
And that's already starting to happen.
Yeah, I like a system where the smartest people want to become doctors.
Yes. Right. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Or entrepreneurs.
Yes.
Innovators.
Yes, please.
Anything.
Well, we fight for freedom, and that is our great commonality here. We are grateful for our American legacy of representative self-government and free enterprise, and we hope that you are too, and that's why you choose to listen to us here at Capital Watch. So that's all the time we have for now, but let's go around the horn. Rebecca, where can people go to learn more about you and your organization and the things that you're doing?
They can find NFIB at nfib.com/PA or Facebook or Twitter.
And Steve, where do folks go to learn about the Commonwealth Foundation?
Commonwealthfoundation.org.
Outstanding. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org or on Sunday mornings at 8:30 on the Pennsylvania Cable Network with PMA Perspective. From Rebecca and Steve and me, thanks very much for listening. We'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. Changes to the way in which Pennsylvania elects statewide appellate court judges and justices and the process for how party nominees for lieutenant governor are selected have been proposed and are now being considered by the state legislature. Each change would require amending the state constitution, so the process is both long and difficult. Voters last week went to the polls and nominated candidates for two open seats on the state superior court. Turnout was low, and it is safe to say most voters knew little, if anything, about the candidates. Judges and justices of Pennsylvania's three appellate courts are elected statewide. Unlike other statewide races, such as governor or U.S. senator, little money is spent on judicial races, and the candidates struggle for attention. The judiciary is one-third of our state government. Judicial races should command the same level of interest and debate as gubernatorial and legislative races, but they do not. Given the enormous influence and impact decisions of the appellate courts have, something needs to change so voters can become more familiar with the candidates. Some would take Pennsylvania in precisely the wrong direction by advocating so-called merit selection of the statewide judiciary. That, however, would merely result in special interests and insiders picking a third of state government, cutting voters out of the process. A better idea has been advanced by State Representative Russ Diamond of Lebanon County. Diamond would divide the state into judicial districts, such as we have for electing members of the legislature or for Congress at the national level. This would accomplish two goals: bring geographically balanced representation to the courts, and by having candidates run in smaller districts, make it easier for them to become known by voters. The challenge to adopting this system is the disproportionate number of judges and justices from the population centers of Pittsburgh and Allegheny County. Many legislators from those areas oppose this reform as they seek to preserve their outsized influence on the courts. Geographically balanced representation, however, is as important for the judiciary as it is for the legislative branch of government. Meanwhile, State Senator David Argel of Schuylkill County has proposed amending the state constitution to allow candidates for governor to select their running mate for lieutenant governor. Currently, candidates for governor and lieutenant governor run separately in the primary, but they are paired in the general election, with voters casting one vote for the nominees as a team. Over the years, this has resulted in some notorious mismatches. Most recently, Governor Tom Wolf was at odds with his first lieutenant governor, Mike Stack. Wolf and Stack never gelled as a team. The relationship hit rock bottom when the governor took Stack's state police detail away from him after the lieutenant governor was accused of mistreating those assigned to protect him. Stack ultimately lost his reelection bid to current Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, with whom Governor Wolf has a warm working relationship. Senator Argel is proposing to have each party's nominee for governor select their lieutenant gubernatorial running mate after the May primary. In that way, similar to how presidential candidates essentially pick their running mate for vice president, the compatibility of the candidates would be assured. It also would eliminate voter confusion that often surrounds the process. For either of these two proposed changes to the process of electing statewide officials to occur requires a state constitutional amendment. That compels the proposed amendments to be approved by two consecutive sessions of the General Assembly and then be placed on the ballot for voter approval. Hypothetically, if the change in the process for electing a lieutenant governor passes this session, it could come up for a legislative vote again early in 2021, and if approved, go on the ballot that November. If approved by voters, it would be in place for the next scheduled gubernatorial election in 2022. That would require a lot to go right, including gaining majority support in both chambers for the proposed amendments. It is a process that seldom works, but adoption of these amendments would greatly improve the process of electing the appellate court judiciary and the state's lieutenant governor. With a town hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 24 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WWSM in Lebanon, WMSS-FM in Middletown, along with WKVE-FM in Mount Pleasant, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Worrell Foundation of Carlisle, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.
Thank you.